Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Wednesday, March 21st. I think this is the first day of spring, if my memory serves me right. So happy spring day to everybody. Tonight, we're going to be chatting with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. We're going to be talking about the politics. We're going to take a look at 2018, so many of the predictions. Barry wrote a really charming article about predicting the future and predictions that he's making for 2020. We'll get into a little bit of that. There's also some brand new polling data on the congressional, what they like to call the generic vote, which is a standard that they've used, I guess, for several elections. And it's one of those things where they ask you, who would you rather vote for in Congress? They're not talking about your district. They're talking in general about Congress. And, you know, it's an indicator of a potential wave, if you will, of one party versus the other. Right now, it's 7.7. That's the average of like 10 or 12 polls. But the last two have come in at 6. And in fact, most of the 9 out of the last 10 have all been single digits. There was one aberration there that I think drove up the average a little bit. So is there going to be a blue wave? Nobody really knows, as Barry has been writing for quite some time and telling us when he's been on the air with us. But it's an interesting topic because I do think there is the possibility for some changes in the U.S. Senate, and we'll talk about that. And then we'll get into what I call the poison in Washington, which is just an effort to undermine President Trump's presidency. And it's getting, I think, it's way over the top, I think, frankly. So we'll see what our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor, has to say. Hi, Barry. How are you?
Good. And yourself?
Just doing great. A week away from the baseball season. So as they say, it's a New Year's Day for you and I when the baseball season starts.
That's true. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes. I
we
think
both
your Yankees
have good
are
teams
actually
this year.
Yeah, I – we do.
We don't
but
know
I think
where
the
they're
going to
end
are
up.
Really good.
But I think they're both good teams.
Yeah, they are. They are. They are. I think the Yankees are getting a lot more publicity to some extent because they're the Yankees, of course. Well, let's talk a little bit about the politics of Washington tonight and talk a little bit about 2018 and this poisonous atmosphere that I talked about. But I want to begin with what happened Tuesday night in the land of Lincoln, Illinois, where they had some very interesting primaries. You alerted me to the one in the U.S. House where a moderate Democrat was challenged by somebody from the left, a lady from the left. That was way too close. He won, but that was very close. What did you think of that? What did you make of that result or any other result in that primary, Barry?
Well, that was clearly the most important race. There was also a governor's race, but that race is now over, I think. The Democrat will be the next governor. But in the House race, in the primary on the Democratic side, a longtime veteran and ally of Nancy Pelosi, and who's one of the two or three or four congressmen, Democratic congressmen, who is pro-life, was challenged from the left, almost was beaten. I think he will probably now win his seat again. But I think what it reveals is what others have been writing about, is that there's now a civil war going on in the Democratic Party. And I think that civil war arises from the 2016 election when the Democratic establishment sort of teamed up, colluded, if you will, with the Hillary Clinton campaign and denied Bernie Sanders the nomination. Some people think that he could have won that if they mm-hmm. hadn't conspired against him, quotation mm-hmm. marks. But
well, that's there was
I think
a lot
there's
of
no question that there's a civil war because mm-hmm. the left, the Bernie Sanders left, is determined not to let the moderate center left, liberal mm-hmm. left prevail anymore, and there's going to be a big battle in primaries and from now until the summer, and then there's going to be a kind of pivotal moment when we see how the left Democratic candidates and the right, more moderate candidates, how they vote when their candidate loses in the primary. Some of them are incumbents. So it's the kind of thing Republicans have done with great panache themselves and goofed themselves up a lot in the recent years. Now the Democrats have caught the disease. It's kind of like an epidemic, and now they're goofing themselves up. I think we're going to have a very interesting 2018 election, as you say. Could be a blue wave, could be a red wave. No wave indicated, really. Everybody wants to interpret various votes as the Pennsylvania 18, for example. But there are all these very interesting developments. Mississippi today, the governor appointed a woman who used to be a Democrat to the Senate seat held by Thad Cochran, and she will face now a very serious primary fight because even though she's been appointed and holds the actual seat, she must go up against go to the voters again in November. Same thing happened in Minnesota when Al Franken resigned. And by the way, both of the appointees are women named Smith.
Interesting.
Kind of coincidence, complete coincidence.
Yeah.
But and both of them face really serious challenges.
And they both represent a state that starts with the letter M. So we're talking about a lot of coincidence there. Minnesota,
yes,
and Mississippi.
Both of the, and both
and
states
Smith, yeah,
are on the same river.
That's right. Okay. So that's one there for all the people who like to do coincidences. But
yes,
let me go back to the race in Illinois, the House race, because I read up a little bit on that campaign. I mean, the attacks on the incumbent in that campaign were vicious. I don't know, you know, when you have a campaign like that that is so close and it's so ideological, is it fair to say that a lot of the people who voted for this lady, I think her last name is Newman, are just going to stay home in November? I mean, or maybe she runs a third party. I mean, because there was a lot of intensity behind this lady, and a lot of it had to do with abortion, LGBT rights, marriage and the definition of marriage.
I think it's too late for a third party. I think you had to register. I'm not sure about that. If it did happen, it would cost them a House seat that would go to the Republicans. That's the kind of thing that's going on in California right now and
right,
a few other places, because this civil war in the Democratic Party is weakening the Democratic effort in 2018.
Let me, Barry, before we get to California, though, and before you go further with your comments about the Civil War, let me go back to Illinois for a second. I just want to go back to Illinois for a second, and then we'll move on to California and your good comments about the Civil War in the Democrat Party. In Illinois, there were two primaries for governor, of course, Democrat and Republican. Just by looking at the numbers of the people who voted, I mean, it's pretty clear to me that the Republican incumbent doesn't have much of a chance. And then on top of that, there's great dissatisfaction with this governor, who I think in the eyes of many of my friends up there in Chicago and so on, was very weak, didn't stand up to the state legislature. Of course, that's always easier said than done, but nevertheless, that's how they feel about him. So he's not creating any enthusiasm on the Republican side. There's not going to be much of a turnout for him. But then on the other side, the Democrat side, you have a candidate who I went to his website last night, so I didn't know much about him. I mean, the entire website is an attack on Trump. Everything is Trump's fault, and he basically, you know, he's like he's running against Trump. He's not even running for governor. And I have a post hopefully coming out tomorrow, where I argue that he's going to win. I'm pretty sure we can predict that. But he's going to end up in the same situation that the governor of New Jersey is now in, with terrible state finances, they're going to have to raise taxes. More people are going to leave the state. They're, you know, it's just a disaster. I mean, the governor of New Jersey also was going to be the resistance against Trump, and now he's facing a lot of internal problems. I feel that that's the same thing that's going to happen in Illinois, because their problems are so structural that what we were hoping was that this Republican governor would really stand up to the legislature. That didn't happen. I don't know what the new Democrat's going to do, Barry. That's kind of a long-winded way to say that I think the next governor of Illinois faces some very serious challenges, Barry.
Well, there's no question about that. The Republican was a very, in order to be a governor in the very, very blue state of Illinois, a Republican had to be a very liberal Republican. And just as in Pennsylvania 18, the Democratic candidate had to be very, very Republican and conservative in order to win. And that's part of the complexity of our election process right now, especially in a midterm when you don't have a presidential candidate and you have these local House races and these statewide Senate races. I think that there's no question that that we face a very interesting year. Mr. Pritzker, the Democrat, spent $70 million in a primary for the Illinois governorship, and he still only got 45% of the vote. The other two candidates had more than a majority between them. He will win, probably, because he'll spend another $70 million if he needs to. He's worth $1 billion, I guess. But I never thought, you know, it was an anomaly that the Republican was the governor of Illinois. I mean, it's the most, after New York and California, the most blue state in the union. And I can't imagine they would have a Republican would have much chance, especially in their financial shape, which is virtual bankruptcy. And maybe it's better that there be a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature to deal with it, because they will be blamed, as they should be, because it's basically the kind of entitlement spending that Illinois indulged in excess, beyond belief, hyper investment in entitlement spending that got them into trouble in the first place. You know, I mean, but I don't think I don't think it's a bellwether of anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think
that it basically means serious, that as you indicated, that Illinois is a very blue state. This governor, you know, many of us thought that the incumbent governor, whose name I think is Rayner, isn't it?
Rauner.
The incumbent governor? Rauner, okay, yeah. The incumbent Republican. I remember when he won in 2014, and it was a surprise. It really was, and it was a pleasant surprise of that election night. And I said to myself, what a great opportunity for this guy to go in there and really take on the public sector unions and really take on the state legislature. And a lot of people thought he would do that, but at the end, either for whatever reason, he didn't. And now he's not popular with anybody, Barry. I mean, the Republicans hate him. The Democrats never liked him. So, I mean, this guy is headed for defeat. He might even lose by 10 points, Barry.
Well, maybe more than that. I don't know. I don't think it makes such difference. As I'm pointing out, it's a very blue state. And it was an anomaly that he won in the first place. And there was no chance for him to initiate policies that would have been conservative, as Scott Walker did in Wisconsin, and the governor Snyder did in Michigan. Illinois is simply not a place. I mean, southern Illinois is pretty conservative, but Chicago and northern Illinois is very, very liberal, very, very unionized, and it was nothing to be done.
Mm-hmm.
It's like California, New York. Especially in the urban areas, they are just so incredibly left of center that it's and the anomalies that do occur. For example, I pointed out in our last conversation, I believe, that there are at least two California House seats that were almost automatic pickups for the Democrats, and they're not going to win because the only two candidates that will be on the ballot in November will be Republicans, because California created a very special law that doesn't exist except in one other state, I believe, where you, instead of having a Republican nominee and a Democratic nominee and even independent nominees, they only allow two nominees, and it's the two greatest vote getters in a primary. So if you've got the two high vote getters are Republicans, that's all that's on the ballot. And the reason that's going to probably happen is because there's like 15 Democrats running, dividing up the Democratic vote. And even though some of them will get very small numbers of votes, some of them will not. And so they'll come in third and fourth. And there's, I believe, only two Republicans running in the two districts. So that's a net loss of two seats that were a sure thing. But again, a highly localized thing. I don't know if it's going to make a huge difference in the final outcome. I don't think there's much question Democrats are going to pick up some seats. Whether they're going to be able to pick up 24 seats remains to be seen. It seems at this point possible, but not necessarily likely. On the other hand, it could become more or less likely depending on economic conditions. I think the whole election will turn on the economic conditions of October, late October 2018.
That's right. That's exactly right. We'll probably get a better feeling for it around Labor Day when people start thinking about the election as well. Now, in California, there may be as many as four of those districts, I believe. And you're right. It's not, if there's a Democrat wave, it doesn't matter. But if you get down to a situation where you got to pick up 24 seats and you basically give up two of them, it could be a factor. It could be a factor. I don't know. Nobody knows. But I did mention before we get to the break, I did tell you, I don't know how much confidence do you place in this generic vote poll that the different organizations are doing. Have you over the years seen it as a bellwether of anything?
Zero influence.
Okay, all right.
Influence. It's a meaningless thing.
No, but in this particular poll,
the poll.
No, what
is
I'm trying to ask
about
you.
Who's going to win or lose? It's about a vague feeling about the two parties, and it's meaningless. And the Democrats always lead in these polls. They were leading in double digits. Then it got down to lower single digits, which it's almost at again. I don't know that it means anything. Again, you and I have discussed the polling. The polling in America, almost without exception, is biased against the Republican Party. Republican voters are very reluctant to answer, even talk to pollsters, or give an answer, or even give a truthful answer. Whereas Democrats are more than eager. So you always have it's based on, I'm not guessing about this, because as we're seeing in virtually all the recent elections, wherever there's a close race, I mean, polls are rare. You don't need a poll to know who's going to win a landslide in a one-sided race. But in those polls, in those elections which were close, the polls have been routinely way off the base. Not always, of course, but routinely. They were off the base in 2016 and many times before, 2014, 2010. Even the exit polls are mistaken these days because the people who take the exit polls have gravitated towards people like themselves who are Democrats. And, you got to have a completely neutral poll. And one of the reasons the polls are so far wrong is because most of the polls are taken by telephone calls. Even if you use cell phones, if you're talking to a, a live person and you're a Trump supporter, you're not going to probably tell them.
Mm-hmm.
So the
well, that's
the
real problem. Yeah, these polls have become a real problem. They were a problem. I mean, on the day of the election in Alabama, Barry, there were two polls. One had Jones up by 10. Another one had Moore up by 10. In Pennsylvania, the consensus was that the Democrat would win 3 to 5 points. And we know what happened in both of those races. It was virtually a tie in the two. So this particular poll, people have relied on it, this generic poll, people have relied on it. But to me, it's only interesting if you've got a double-digit lead, 12, 13, 14. If it's 7 or 6, that's almost a margin of error. And you have to begin to wonder, something in the margin of error can go either way. So,
but Silvio, the fact is, it's not a poll about who you're going to vote for. It's a poll about mood, and it's again a poll to voters who the people who answer the poll are mostly on one side. So, I give it zero. I mean, you're giving much too much attention to it because it's.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you, let me take a quick break. You take care of that phone call or that phone call that you're getting in. Let me take a little break when we come back. Are you all right? Okay. All right.
I'm okay.
No, good. I just thought maybe you had your phone ringing. We have to take a break, and I thought I'd give you a chance to catch up with that or at least reply and tell him you're calling back. Let me, Barry, take a little break. And when we come back with our friend Barry, we're going to be talking a little bit about the poisonous atmosphere in the country, what appears to be, at least for many of us, an effort to bring down President Trump. I mean, I never thought I would say something like that, but it is really remarkable what is happening in the country. So we're going to take a little break. We're going to hear the music of my friend Carlos Geddes, and we're also going to hear from one of the Blog Talk Radio sponsors. We'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. We're chatting today with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. We're going to get into 2018 and the poisonous atmosphere in the country and a recent post that Barry just posted about a fun prediction that he makes about 2020. But before we go there, I just wanted to see if anybody in the audience remembers what happens on this night or what happened on this night 37 years ago today, 1980, what happened on this day, I should say, in 1980. And that was the night that they shot J.R. Ewing. I saw this in the news today. So 37 years ago, everybody was watching Dallas and J.R. was shot. And then we spent the next 8 months speculating as to who shot him. So J.R. was shot 37 years ago. The amazing thing about that is that it was 37 years ago. It's just hard to believe that 1980 was 37 years ago. Let's get back to our friend Barry Castleman. How are you, Barry?
I'm fine.
Great. Did you ever watch Dallas?
No,
years
never
ago?
Watched.
Yeah, I was a fan.
I'm not a TV guy.
Yeah, well, I was never a big, big fan. I didn't, you know, my life was not turned upside down if I missed a show. But I do think there are times when you have a television show that it's a real phenomenon. And I think Dallas became that in the late 70s and into the early 80s. Let's get back to our politics. Barry, I loved your last post about the predictions of 2020. And I loved your prediction for 2020. Maybe you could share that with the audience and the context of your wonderful post, Barry.
Well, I made only one prediction. I said I wasn't going to. This was not a year for making predictions, because so much is unsettled and undefined. But I did stick my neck out. I said that I predict that the Democratic nominee for president in 2020 will be someone who is not 65 years of age or older.
Well,
so that eliminates four.
Yeah, who does that? Who does that
candidates
eliminate? Yeah,
right now.
Tell me who that eliminates. That would eliminate Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton,
Elizabeth Warren.
Are those the four you were thinking of?
That's the four. I also think it probably Martin O'Malley is 64.
Oh, okay, so he's just there.
So he barely makes it. He's certainly not going to be the nominee. There's a whole bunch of candidates who are in their 40s and 50s,
mm-hmm.
Even one in their late 30s, Julian Kander. And so there's a whole bunch of young people, and I think one of them will emerge. But there's so many. Right now, there's a calculation that there may be up to 45 relatively serious candidates for president on the Democratic side. Now, of course, the Republican side is a done deal as long as the president decides to run. Although people like John Kasich and
mm-hmm.
Jeff Flake are talking about running, probably as independents. I think the problem for them is if they run as independents, they'll take more votes away from the Democratic nominee than from Trump, because there are a whole bunch of people who were never going to vote for Trump, who were going to vote for the Democrat. But if they've got a moderate centrist, they'll vote for him, and that'll cost votes for the Democrat. It's
right.
kind of thing what happened in 1948, if you recall, when mm-hmm. Harry Truman ran against Thomas Dewey, and there was a candidate on the far left and a candidate on the far right, and they each got more than a million votes, but it didn't affect the outcome. And because both of them, by the way, were Democrats. One was a conservative Democrat, one was a liberal Democrat, and Truman won anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So independent candidates are greatly exaggerated. I think one of the few times it made a difference was 1992, when your fellow Texan, Ross Perot, probably, but not certainly, cost George H.W. Bush the election.
Mm-hmm.
That's not exactly clear, and Mr. Perot is very adamant about that he didn't do it, but I'm not so sure. Anyway, that's one of the rare cases.
Yeah. Sure.
And of course,
well, George Wallace too in 19. No, but wait a minute. George Wallace in 68 did very well, but he didn't. He actually won some states, but he was not a factor. Although some people say those states would have gone to Humphrey. I don't know.
And then there was the candidate in 2000. It didn't take very many votes to alter the difference, since the election was decided by 600 votes.
Right.
And what's his name?
Right, I know Ralph Nader.
Got a couple million votes, or at least a million votes. And mm-hmm. in Florida, he got a whole bunch in Florida, and probably cost the election. But it does, as we always say, when the elections are close, every vote counts, and they do. And the 2020. I wrote it was sort of tongue-in-cheek because I said it's awfully early, and the elections keep getting earlier and earlier. And I can't tell you, even though only one Democrat has announced, a congressman, I think, from Ohio or someplace, there are about 30 candidates who are actively organizing mm-hmm. and hiring and fundraising for the presidential campaign. And here we are 2.5 years away, more than 2.5 years away. So, but that's the way things are, largely because of money and communications. You have to start early, we have a whole. But we have. I think I listed about 14 first of all, I listed the four older ones, and then about another 14 candidates. And I just named some of the most prominent ones. I left out probably a couple. And then there's about 20 others. I mean, we're talking people who are governors, congressmen, former cabinet officers. I mean, we're not talking about unknown wacko candidates. There is an interesting couple of mayors running, the mayor of Los Angeles and the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, are two actually very interesting candidates. I don't know if they can be nominated, but they're they're apparently going to run. And then, of course, there's always Oprah. Winfrey.
Right, and who knows who could run. I mean, Michelle Obama, there's talk about her as well. My sense is that they could get to the, you know, the debates. They'll get to the debates, and they'll have to have, like the Republicans did, you know, debate one, debate two, you know, prime time, the other. I mean, they're going to have to do like the Republicans, where they had two debates the same night because of all of the candidates. But my sense, when I read your article, which I loved quite a bit, but my sense is that a lot's going to depend what happens in November, and also where everything is at the end of 2019, because let's say summer of 2019 or the fall of 2019, Trump looks in pretty good shape. In other words, he looks like he will be reelected. I think it's going to be a lot more difficult for that many people to justify fundraising. Now, if the Democrats pick up the House and maybe the Senate in the fall, then I think all bets are off, because then everybody will want to jump in. I also feel, Barry, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I also think that if Trump looks pretty electable or reelectable in the fall of 2019, that I wouldn't be surprised if the Democrats go to Vice President Biden and say, hey, we need somebody to run in 2020, and you're the perfect guy because you're one candidate we can burn because you don't have a future anyway. I know that's very cynical of me to say that, but he would be the perfect sacrificial candidate in 2020 against a strong President Trump, Barry.
Well, they, all four of the old ones would be, even Mrs. Warren, certainly Bernie, and they're all pretty, you know, they're all in their mid-70s or early to mid-70s, and they'd be in their 80s if they got elected president. And so therefore, this would be their last possible election. But I don't think they have the energy to they wouldn't capture the American public. The American public, given Donald Trump, would be looking for, if they're looking for an alternative, they would be looking for a young, fresh face, man or woman, who would be give them a sense of an alternative program for government. None of the other four. I mean, it's true, Bernie and Elizabeth Warren have an alternative, but it's basically socialism. And I don't think that's where the country is going to go.
No, I don't think so either. Now, they could always nominate the young man who won in Pennsylvania, the ex-Marine, who's an extremely attractive candidate, very telegenic and, you know, pro-life and all of that. I mean, somebody like that, but I don't think he would run. But, you know, somebody like that would be very attractive.
Whether his qualifications for president. You know,
well, he doesn't have any tangible, but neither did President Obama, though, with all due respect. I mean, President Obama had never really run anything. I mean, he was a senator, the Senate is obviously a distinguished institution, but 2 years in the Senate doesn't usually make you, a statesman.
And the result was as predictable as from my
point
of view.
No, absolutely.
I mean, it wasn't a very distinguished presidency.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. And there may be
some scandals. I mean, there are those who will disagree with that because that's what they wanted. They wanted a president who would withdraw essentially America's role in the world and who would essentially increase taxes and increased spending. Although I must say, the Republicans seem to be doing a pretty good job of the latter themselves. So,
yes, unfortunately, you're right. I think the Republicans are going to have to remember their speech. The Republicans are going to have to remember all those speeches about deficits, because you're right. There's some pretty big deficits. I think what they're banking on, Barry, is that the growth of the economy will lower some of those deficits. But yeah, I agree with you. Let me hear in the few minutes we have, about 5 minutes we have, I want to touch on, I want to get your sense, not just from the analysis that you do, but just your historical sense. You're a student of history. I think there's a lot of poison in Washington right now, and it's making it almost impossible to get anything done, because the Democrats have no interest in getting anything done. Many in the media seem out to get this President Trump, and President Trump doesn't always help either by some of the tweets he puts out. So it just seems like, you know, a lot of people look at Washington and they see what they like to call a dysfunctional operation, Barry. How do you see it, and how does it compare maybe to other times in history?
Well, when you make the point about other times in history, that's when it comes back into focus. It seems like, because compared to what we remember in recently, in most of a good part of our last 30 years, 40 years, it seems very extreme, very poisonous. We forget it was pretty poisonous around Ronald Reagan, and certainly poisonous around Barry Goldwater, and poisonous around Harry Truman and Roosevelt. And then when you go back into history in the 19th century, the poison that we see today isn't half as toxic as used to be done from 1800 to 1900, which is the 19th century. It was a pretty poisonous environment, where the media was even more, if it's possible, more out of control than it is today. But there were no standards in those days. But you are right. There's I have a new piece coming in which I argue that the reason there is this polarization is because the always important, always vital political center in America, and political center does not imply middle, and it also doesn't imply Democratic or Republican. Political center is about the majority. We're a very majoritarian country, and as long as we are, we're okay. The moment we cease to be majoritarian, I think we're in trouble, and we become like Italy. But the political center has been what I call the silence of the center, and for the last, since 9/11, I think, to a large extent, the political center has been pretty quiet. Interesting enough, we had a centrist government from 1995 to 1999 under the sort of co-leaders of President Clinton and Newt Gingrich, the speaker, because each of them were, one was a right of center, the other was a left of center, but they were both centrists. And they, one of the things, the hallmarks of the center is negotiation, of compromise. That means things can get accomplished. In the era of Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, a compromise was no longer possible, and it almost continued into the first year of the Trump administration. Finally, the president actually, I think through his leadership and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, finally overcame the stalemate and actually got something through, which was the tax bill, which is, I believe, going to be the key legislation that will determine the outcome of 2018, perhaps even 2020, although I think by 2019, the Republican Congress, if there is a Republican Congress, will have to do more than just a tax bill.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have to resolve the issue of health care,
mm-hmm.
of education, of national security. I mean, there's so many things to be done. Infrastructure, the wall. There's so many issues that need to be worked on and resolved, and we haven't been doing that, and that's because the political center, and there's a right of center and a left center, but it's more, remember I said it's not in the middle exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of where the majority are, and we're a very majoritarian country. So one of the reasons we accomplished so much in the post-war period of civil rights and desegregation and of the right to vote, full suffrage for everyone, and what we're doing now to a certain extent with political correctness is because the political center just has rejecting the old ways.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that Donald Trump has succeeded in what he's doing with political correctness is because, not because Donald Trump is against it, he's just using it. The fact of the matter is, the country is tired of political correctness.
Right.
And they've decided to reject it. And so whoever speaks to that language, speaks to that issue, effectively will win, whether they be a Democrat or a Republican.
That's right.
And so far,
right.
it's been mostly Republicans. And that's part of the reason why Republicans are winning.
Right, exactly. And I think
not that
Donald Trump. No, it really isn't. It really isn't.
You know, people make things out to be very complicated. It's not that complicated. The issues are fairly direct. One of the reasons that one of the changes going on in the country, we haven't talked about this, so it's
mm-hmm.
really a subject for a whole program, is
sure.
the transformation of the Republican Party from an elite establishment conservative party to a blue-collar, working-class conservative party.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And that's one of the reasons why all the anti-Trumpers on the right are from the political elites,
mm-hmm.
because he has upset their apple cart. And
that's right. Good
and point. They're upset, but and they're never going to be satisfied. That's
well, I
the
tell
problem.
You what, we will pick up on that topic. We'll do quite a bit on that topic because I agree with you. I mean, you can see it in the South, the emergence of the Republican Party in the South. A lot of it is rural, not elites. I mean, a lot of them are rural communities, and there's no doubt at what you're saying. But I will tell you, I have never seen it this poisonous, and I do believe, Barry, that one of the things, and I'll just make one more point here, one of the things that contributes to the poison, it's almost like adding poison to poison, is social media, where I think social media has, I mean, there's wonderful things about social media. I mean, you and I are talking on the internet, which is part of social media. I mean, so social media gives you and I the opportunity to reach people with our ideas. Social media gives you the opportunity to write your wonderful blog, you know, the Prairie Editor. It gives the good people at American Thinker the opportunity to publish their website. But that's the good part. The negative part is that there's no editorial supervision. So you see stuff on, you know, anybody can basically write anything they want. And I think sometimes that just puts more fuel in the fire. And it just makes it more and more difficult to have any kind of compromise. I mean, the DACA debate is an interesting debate because the fact is the majority of Americans would like to see something done about DACA. And the majority of the Americans would like to see something done about the border. And yet, you know, you would think that there's your deal right there. Let's do DACA and let's do the border. But they can't get anything done. I mean, which is remarkable, Barry.
Right, because there's the political center of both parties, the centrists,
mm-hmm.
the Joe Manchins and Heidi Heitkamp,
right,
and the centrists on the right, are not in control. And they are, in fact, and as we're seeing in the primaries this year, we just talked about it at the outset of the program, some of these centrists are under attack from their own party to, you know, trying to eliminate them. I mean, the two political parties 30 years ago each had a mixture of pro-life and pro-choice elected officials and candidates. Today, if you're pro-life, you can't possibly, I mean, there's one or two left, and Mr. Dolinsky basically survived by a few thousand votes. Or if you're pro-choice, there's no place for you in the Republican Party. So we're seeing that kind of polarity. But those issues aren't really, in my view, an abortion issue is not really a partisan issue, per se. It's a genuine issue, and legitimate. But no party has should have ownership of it. Each party should have a space in each party for people who hold those views, opposite views, to exist and to be part of the party. But that's not.
No, you're exactly not. That's not what's happened at all. Even on the issue of traditional marriage, I mean that is an issue where the parties are, you know, generally one party versus the other on that issue. Well, Barry, as always, thank you for your time and thank you for helping us understand these things a little bit better. We have a link to the Prairie Editor and the show information, and we always recommend it to our friends and family. And let's, the next time we chat, let's talk about the some of these concepts about the center. When that article gets posted about the center, let's hold on to that one and talk about it on our next program, Barry, because I'm really interested on that one. That should be a great topic.
Well, I'm looking forward to it too.
All right. The next time we chat, there will be baseball. So that's good for you and me. That's good for you and me.
Well, it's our season. We got through we're almost through with the basketball season. And
pretty close.
March Madness, of which I have little interest, but I respect my friends who get mad.
That's right. Barry, have a great evening, and thank you as always for your time, and it's always great to be to have you on the show.
Well, the pleasure is mine. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor, as we always like to say, check out his website. You know, I'm a subscriber. I got a subscription for one of our sons, and it's really, really a wonderful, just an absolutely wonderful website to get some of the best analysis that you're going to get in politics these days. I mean, you don't get right, you don't get left, you get a very thoughtful point of view. It's not one way or the other. It's a very thoughtful analysis of the news. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. And again, our thanks to Barry Castleman. We'll talk to you later.